Good evening. Tonight, we bring you a conversation with Niall Quinn, recorded in front of an audience at the Hinterland Festival in Kells, County Meath, earlier this year. The subject is the life of Oscar Traynor. Had things panned out differently, Traynor might have had a long and distinguished career as a professional goalkeeper in the 1910s. But when you are driven to take part in the Easter Rising and assume command of the Dublin Brigade of the IRA during the War of Independence, football becomes secondary. In his master's thesis for Dublin City University, Niall Quinn has traced Traynor's long and varied career in football, revolution and politics. August of 2022, a master's thesis in history was presented for examination in Dublin City University. It was entitled Oscar Traynor, a reevaluation of a footballer, rebel, politician and football administrator. Happily, the thesis was passed and the candidate graduated, and he joins us here today. I assume no further introduction is necessary. Would you please welcome Niall Quinn?
Thank you.
Now, Niall and I will be talking exclusively about Oscar Traynor, but then we'll throw it open to the audience and there may be some non-Oscar Traynor related questions. I'm sure Niall will be happy to accept them. Okay, first of all, congratulations. I've read it and it is a beautifully written work and it should be accessible outside of academia. You know, two copies lodged in Dublin City University is not enough. So, I mean, are you interested in having it published so that everyone can read it and see, A, what an excellent historian you are, and B, how interesting Oscar Traynor was?
Well, I started out to do this because there was one thing cropped up when I was in the FAI during the pandemic, going in there in a kind of emergency position for 9 months. And I was waiting to have a meeting in the boardroom, and there was all of the photographs of every president that the association had, and everybody was 2 years. And this man, called Oscar Traynor, was 14 years. And that just intrigued me, and then later on I was pushed into doing the master's in revolutionary history by my family, who were all studying at the time. My wife had gone back studying and she was unsufferable, saying how good it was all of the time. She left school at 14, went back at 40, about to complete a doctorate now in the next sort of few months. So you can imagine what was going on in our house, because my daughter was doing her master's and my son was doing his. So we're in the pandemic and there was nothing else going on. So I got into this being pushed in one way, but once it started, it was great. And I really loved what I was doing. But what I found out, and a long way of getting to the answer, but after my thesis was published, I got to meet the Traynor family. And I didn't know them beforehand, which was an awful pity, because when I met them afterwards, there was a load more material available that I didn't have. But what I found from them was quite an amazing thing. One, what I had written was the most they had ever seen about their grandfather and great-grandfather, which I found startling. And secondly, the amount of stuff they have, the private stuff they have, that would be incredible in many ways, they have a feeling that Oscar himself didn't want to get it out there, then maybe we should respect that and not do it. Mm. So I respect that too, and so I haven't got the urge to go off and tell everybody. I think it's their call. Mm. If to do that, but I think it's so interesting from somebody who played sport, who played soccer. He was a soccerite, I think that's what they used to call him, the soccerites, the Shaneens, and the soccerites. Oscar Traynor, I think I have a small debt to pay to him, because even though he had passed away by the time the GAA lifted the ban on playing soccer, I was from a very GAA background. I got playing in 1972 in the local street league, and I would not have been allowed had the ban still been in place, and he did more than anybody over the years to try and help how soccer had been suppressed in the country, over and above all of the roles he had in government, etc. He was one of the great soccer people, and I don't know, there's no statues of soccer people at the Aviva. They say Jack Charlton should have one. I'd have this guy way ahead of that for minding soccer when it was it wasn't part of the nationalist program of the new country, and how the country was going to pan out. And he fought for it all the way, took on church, took on politics, took on the GAA, of course. And I'm not anti-GAA, I'm very pro-GAA, But I would have a huge personal debt, I think, that where my career turned out.
Because I must say, I've always loved the guy because of what he did or what he said or what he didn't do or didn't say to John Charles McQuaid. We'll come to that. Definitely. We're definitely coming to that one. One of your aims, though, was you say it, I think, in the introduction, to retrieve the story of Oscar Traynor from the footnotes of Irish history. Now, you know, he's got a road named after him in Coolock, so is he really a footnote?
I was ready for this question, and I think I found out there's over 200,000 roads in Ireland.
Right.
So giving
good
him
one,
one of 200,000 doesn't seem a fair return.
Fair enough.
I think when you look at what he did, okay, as a soccer player, which you mentioned, his role in the revolution, you know, his many roles, extraordinary. And then to go into the world of politics and deal with it the way he did, and to be our longest serving minister for many, many years, nearly 30 years a minister. And just on politics alone, he was the Minister of Defence for the entire World War II. Nobody gives him a pat on the back for that at all. It was all De Valera. De Valera kept us neutral. But he would have done all of the hard work in and around shaping that. And then, of course, in his administration as president of the FAI, nursing it, bringing it through great times, the 50s was the heyday of soccer in Ireland, sell-out crowds at all the matches. And he was there fighting for it against sort of government, against the church and against the GAA. And we've a lot to be grateful to him for, I believe. But his story doesn't get the billing it deserves, I think, because of those reasons. He was a soccer man. He took on the church at a time when that was taboo, the GAA in the same way. But he was also anti-treaty when it came to it, and as the reshuffling of the order came about, I think that stood against him. But he never looked for it either. I think that's the other thing that came out in the work that I did. He's somebody who I think possibly deserves more than the street there up in Coolock.
This is why I want you to publish the book. But anyway, that's another story. Okay, let's start with his nationalist background. I mean, yeah. I was fascinated by the fact that his father was deemed to be important enough a figure to lower Parnell's coffin into the grave in Glasnevin in 1891. So how big an influence was his father, or the memory of his father, he died young, on Oscar's political philosophy?
Well, you'd start tracing back afterwards and look back at things, but that must have been an incredible day, 200,000 people lining the streets, being at this funeral, and he's one of, you know, six pallbearers. He had a bookshop on Abbey Street there, just near Essex Quay, at the start of Abbey Street, where Oscar was brought up in the early years. And there is, in Liam Skinner's short appraisal of Oscar Traynor's career that was written in 1946, he does mention the fact that a young Oscar Traynor remembered famous Gaels coming to the house for meetings. So you had Michael Davitt from the GAA, you'd sort of, Clossie was another great Land League man at the time. So his father was nearby, and also it's as if, without being terribly public about it, it was like as if he was handling things behind the scenes, because he was also the person that was given the, he would have taken Parnell's will and made sure that was distributed the way it should be. There's a term for it now that escapes me.
But not an executor, was he?
As I think it was a different term in those days. So he was in and around it, but of course, you know, a couple of years, not long after, Oscar Traynor's father passed away. And he had two brothers and a sister, but he was 13 and a half. And he decided, I'm going to leave school. I got to go out and help the family. So what I think is remarkable then, when you come around to 1916, and there's a lot of in-between there and how the country was shaping up, but the poets and the scholars and the romantic notions that brought us 1916 that he was in the middle of, well, he was like working at 13 and a half. He was not educated. And yet he could become, you know, the longest serving minister this country has ever seen. So at that time, going back to the direct question, you would have to say it was a huge influence. And what was quite noticeable from the family after the father's death was in the 1901 census, it was all filled out in English. But 10 years later, the Traynor family filled their census forms out Osgaelge. So in there were his teenage years and getting to become a young man. And it would appear that he was influenced. Now, there were other influences that come into it through his soccer. For instance, he was a very good soccer player. He was, there was a team called Frankfurt, And he played with a guy called Joe Wickham, who'll come into the story later, who I think is one of the greatest servants to Irish football. I should have mentioned him alongside Jack Charlton and Oscar. But they played together as kids at Frankfurt. Oscar kicked on to a club called Stranville, and from Stranville he went to Belfast Celtic, which was like today going to Manchester United as much. And that was an amazing thing to happen to him. He was a goalkeeper, a very kind of safe pair of hands in many ways. Interestingly, when he got up to Belfast, it was just heating up. Sectarianism was just heating up before World War One, and
well, it was the time of the Home Rule Bill and the passage of the Home Rule Bill.
I think 500,000 people signed the Ulster Covenant up there. Sectarianism was coming strong, and he would have noticed that. But in his couple of years up there, he'd won great year where they won everything, and they were also the first Irish team ever to go abroad and play matches on mainland Europe. And they went to Germany, they went to Prague, they went to so many different places to play matches. And their guest of honour was a man called Cathal O'Byrne, who was a Belfast native, very much part of the nationalist movement, a great musician, a great poet, one of the sort of typical people who would end up in 1916. But he was also great friends with Roger Casement, and he led the kind of every night dancing, whatever was going on, and the exchange of culture that was going on with these people who had been oppressed as well in these various countries. And there's no doubt Traynor had to have been influenced in some way by that. And then I think what really influenced him the most, I suppose, was seeing up there firsthand in Belfast how the tide was turning and how, you know, the Catholics were not getting a fair shake of the deal.
I mean, you write about a match between Belfast Celtic and Linfield on the 24th of September, 1912, and one can only imagine what went on there. One has, thinking 1994, Windsor Park, Ireland versus Northern Ireland.
It was November 93 for the 94 World Cup. But in that whole story of the match in 1912, Traynor had a good run. He'd played very, very well, and he had really made a name for himself, and it's brilliant because there's so much press cuttings and clippings of the matches from that time. There's even his matches in Dublin, the youth matches with Stranville and Frankfurt. You can go right back where you get the teams and the result. But Belfast was different. A newspaper called The Sport do what I suppose in my day The Pink used to be after matches way back in the 80s and 90s. And there are match reports and comments by press. And he gets such favourable commentary. You know, he's one set for the top. You know, it won't be long till he'll be wearing the national jersey. A fine custodian. All this over an 18-month period. And then that game you talk about happens. Belfast Celtic play at Linfield. And everything is fine. Linfield went 1-0 up just before halftime. But remember, it's as things are really heating up. And at half-time, the players came back out for the second half, waiting for the game to start. Some shots were heard in the crowd, and then there was indiscriminate shooting throughout the ground. So everybody ran where they could. Five people got shot, three inside the ground, two outside. Wasn't enough RUC to deal with that. Eventually, they got it under control. But it was something that had never happened before, shootings at a match. We were to have Bloody Sunday years later. Yeah. But this was a pre-runner to that. And his dip in form starts that day, because when the game was rearranged about 4 weeks later, by the time they played it in Linfield, Linfield won 4-0. But there's an amazing objection that I found that put into the Irish Football Association, who were in charge at the time. And the objection was from Belfast Celtic to say, we couldn't concentrate with all the shooting that was going on, because it was volleys of shots going in the air. They all had the guns had come in. The Catholic team didn't. And when we start to think of Traynor and his position, see, the goalkeepers didn't run around as much as they do in the modern game, and so he's a sitting duck. And it's very interesting that the next six or eight games that he played, it culminates with the press saying, one of them, I think this fella needs a rest. He's not playing the way that we know he can play. So it had an effect on him. There's no doubt about that. And the following season, there's a lovely list of players that have signed for clubs, those who haven't, and they have what's called the idle list. And his name was on the idle list. He had no club for the following season. And I'll bring you back 6 months earlier, the Linfield goalkeeper got signed by Liverpool and became a legend. Elisha Scott became a legend in Liverpool, their longest serving player ever, and there's still murals today of the goalkeeper on the Linfield team at Anfield, as they've built their new stadium, they remember him. So that's the kind of circles he was mixing in. But also there was sectarianism in the air. You know, there was a lot more at play, and he found himself having had that great sort of, I suppose, run at the top end of professional soccer, earned him, you know, money that he wouldn't have been earning in Dublin. Not huge, but far more than what he would have been earning in terms of his wage as a compositor. But to have it end so quickly, but still to love the game and retain that love for the game and to wholly defend it from that time on was exceptional. It
could have been so different, but he comes back to Dublin in 1913. He joins the Volunteers. What part did he play in the 1916 Rising?
Well, first of all, he came back in the middle of the lockout. So the lockout was just Dublin, 20,000 people being locked out of work. You know, batting charges most days where working people were being taken apart, really. It was an awful time. And interestingly, years later, you know, speaking to his grandson, his family always said he was more a Labour man than Sinn Féin or Fianna Fáil, who he later joined. So this was kind of probably where that stemmed from. And he decided to join the Volunteers. He joined up at Fairview Park when he came back in 1913. And he was immediately seen as somebody with a cool head, and he was put in charge of drills. A lot of the soldiers there, they had a penny rifle range where they would come and do drills at the rifle range. And on one occasion, the military police came along to try and disband them. A large crowd of volunteers had gathered. And he held the standoff conversation, and he got them to back off, and he got them out of there. And Harry Colley, who witnessed it later, said that was our first sign that this guy had something more than the rest of us. And so he was shown his leadership qualities. Then, you know, Redmond and the Fisher, whereby, you know, he wanted the Volunteers to go and fight for Britain in the war, and that we would get our home rule. Well, the entire country kind of went 90-10 for that. But Traynor, who was very prominent in that part of the Dublin Volunteers, he was in F Company to begin with and would work his way up, they were sort of 50-50. So a big chunk of people said no to Redmond and formed a different idea about nationalism and how we would then see that it would end up being 1916 would come along. Now, not just because of what happened in Fairview, there was obviously a collection of things happened, but they were absolutely adamant that they were going all the way, and that most of them later were anti-treaty is no surprise. Mm. You know, he was considered of enough stature to be invited to the famous meeting that took place in the O'Rahilly home, whereby leaders of the revolution would meet. I think Kiant was there, Clark. There was quite a lineup. And he talks in his witness statement about Pádraig Pearse making a late sort of arrival and coming in and taking everybody, you know, to his hearts. And he spoke, you know, about we've prepared, we've drilled, we've prepared. From tonight, we prepare our souls. And so from that moment on, something big was going to happen. And he played a cool hand with all that, but eventually got his team ready out in Fairview. His battalion were ready to go. And, of course, the order came then from McNeill that all operations were off, and that confused people. But I think typical of Traynor, he didn't just accept that and go home. He got everybody together, went into Dublin himself, found out what was happening, barely got out, got his group together and brought them back into Sackville Street, as it was. And himself and the two Henderson brothers, who were part of his battalion, were commandeered by Connolly. They were given individual jobs to do with about 20 to 25 volunteers each. And Oscar Traynor headed up the group that took the Metropole Hotel, Easton's bookstore, right the way down, right near where he was born, Abbey Street, where he lived, where O'Connell Street comes. And his job was to get as quickly as possible to get holes in every wall so that they could tunnel through and go all the way out and have escape routes, etc. So he was deemed leadership material enough to do that. And eventually he makes his way across the GPO as Metropole Hotel is in flames. He speaks in his witness statement about seeing the clock, which we know the clock at Cleary's melting. Such was the heat, and that's why they had to go. They went into the GPO. They were on their last legs in the GPO, and now they're tunneling out walls down towards the back of Henry Street to try and come out again. So he played a prominent role, and I think a good measure, I think, of his importance in 1916 was as the Irish prisoners were being released to come back to Ireland a year later, some of them in August, some of them September, October. He was on the last batch that came on Christmas Eve. So I think that kind of tells you that the British thought he was high up there as well. And
he would have come out at the same time as a rather prominent Cork man named Michael Collins.
Correct. Yeah. And it seems that they were really close at times because it was actually Oscar Traynor who said we should start an active service unit. We should start a professional organisation that can do this kind of thing. And Michael Collins then brought that a step further, obviously, with the squad and what have you. But there was hardly an incident in Dublin, because the guerrilla tactics used, you know, that were used out in the country so successfully, there was also, you know, quick skirmish shooting kills in Dublin that Collins, you know, was very part of. But Traynor would have been involved in planning for all of them. He was kind of seen as this this guy who'll come back, this is what I think, this is how you should do it. And he would have overseen it as well. He got dirty as well himself, you know. He did attend a few of the events, particularly on a Guinness steamer that he managed to get a load of rifles off. He went in and led that. There was a very famous time when he went in to hold up what it was called, the rink, which is where all the mails were kept, for, you know, coming from Britain, all of the mail to Ireland. And he held up that, and he did the planning all around that, and there was a lovely headline in the paper that evening, because he didn't realise the chutes where all the mail came down, but he used that as escape, and all the IRA men came down the chutes, and he quickly took his clothes off and had a bike nearby and pretended he was coming from the swimming, and he was able to escape. So he was quite clever. He was quick on his feet and quick in mind. And so he was doing well as you know, as sort of 1916 had ended. He'd come back into the volunteers. They were pushing on for more. The War of Independence was coming, and Collins taught a lot of what he was doing and had his ear.
I mean, he was hugely prominent in the Dublin Brigade. He would have been junior to McGee and Clancy until, obviously, the 21st of November 1921. Now, interestingly, you talk about the guerrilla tactics and guerrilla skirmishing and all of that, but one of the actions that he is most associated with, obviously, was the attack on the Custom House in 1921. Now, you know, we can talk afterwards about whether it was a disaster or whether it was not a disaster, but first question about that was he railroaded into that assault by the newly returned Eamon de Valera, who had ideas above his station, having come back from the USA?
Yeah, it's a pertinent question for sure, and it is quite obvious that de Valera had found out that there's a new tool, propaganda, out there. I've been away, we can really use this, and we need something big. In actual fact, he said it's detrimental if we keep these one-off skirmishes going, that's not being received well. We're like cold-blooded killers.
It's not cricket.
It's not cricket, correct. And as a result, the feeling was that a big one is the way to go. And I think that mightn't have sat well with Collins, because Collins was at that meeting. Well, again, this was in Dawson Street, where they had this particular meeting after de Valera came home. And de Valera spoke about, you know, the importance of this, and it was up to Traynor to come up with, well, what are we going to do? And there was two options. There was to go to Beggar's Bush Barracks and make a big spectacular against the British soldiers that were stationed there, or the Custom House. And so Traynor staked out the Custom House for some time. Cheekily went in with an envelope every day on Her Majesty's service, or His Majesty's as it was at the time, and found himself being able to go wherever he wanted. One of his best friends and later colleague in North Dublin in the elections there at local TD, Harry Colley, actually worked in there, had a job. So they were an inside sort of track on how things were. And he came out and felt that against the potential bloodbath that would be taking on the soldiers in their own barracks.
And it would cripple the British administration in Ireland, because it was the Exchequer, essentially.
Yes, absolutely. So next to Dublin Castle, as you said, you know, this was kind of where the paperwork was kept, where the real running of the country by Britain was sort of administered from. And they understood the importance of this, and how do they make a successful attack. And the attack didn't go to plan. How many do, I would say? But going back to the direct question, he was so loyal he wouldn't have felt railroaded. He would have felt it's one or the other, and I think this is the best. And where it's, I think it's one of the most debated parts of the War of Independence, sure. You know, some people say it was a catastrophe. What did they do that for? They ruined all these records from the 9th, 10th, 11th centuries. But then, you know, you have to point out and say, how quickly did Lloyd George come to the table afterwards to write to De Valera and hold out a hand of truce? You know, within 4 to 5 weeks, that had arrived. Mm-hmm. And 3 weeks later, suddenly, you know, the deal is starting to be put on the table. So, you know, when I look back, again, had Traynor been loud and vociferous and drummed at home in books and what have you years later on, that, you know, that we did what we did, he just references it in one article that he wrote, which was a brigade article for IRA in their own sort of community. And he defended De Valera as it was the right thing to do, in as much that the spectacular, I think De Valera was reported to have said, if all of the 100 who were arrested died, look what we got out of it. It was the right thing to do. And then, of course, you have civil war not long afterwards, and people take sides, and it was thrown back at Traynor then that the Custom House wasn't the right thing to do. But, you know, I really enjoyed the part of the research that I loved about the Custom House, the burning of the Custom House. I found somebody who had written on it and had actually defended Traynor, which was interesting. Liz Gillis had put a man who's no longer with us, Michael O'Davlin, they put a lot of research into it, and they the feeling was that, you know, that Traynor had done what he was asked to do. The fire brigade came to the rescue by keeping the fire going for 2 weeks, you know, so they were as important as anyone. But the most important thing, I think, was the amount of arrests, which is often called a catastrophe. You know, there was probably, on the mark of nearly 90 volunteers arrested, 5 killed, some civilians killed as well. There have been far bigger casualty lists and far bigger, I suppose, worse results, let me say. But I think when you realise at the time, and the research that they put into it, which I was delighted to read, made life easy for me, there was 4,500 active volunteers in Dublin at that time. 90. Might have been good ones and further up the chain, but 90 were taken out, and 5 died. The most saddest, I think, of the deaths of all was a man called Dan Head, a young man. He was a teenager, but he was a goalkeeper, like Traynor. And he saw Traynor and Tom Ennis coming under attack as a British lorry came in, and they'd answered the call because there'd been confusion inside in the Custom House, and 2 whistles were blown when there should have been 1. That caused consternation. The fire hadn't really got going. So there was a different kind of exit than planned. And Tom Ennis and Traynor were walking straight into an oncoming truckload of British soldiers. And Dan Head, who was preparing some mortars and different things, saw what was happening, came up and threw the live mortar into their lorry. 5 casualties there in terms of count of soldiers. This is according to the British, who didn't always record how many losses they had. But another lorry came and shot Dan Head dead as he was trying to get away. But Traynor and Tom Ennis' lives were saved. Tom Ennis had been hit in the fire. And this is where it started to get really sad for me, because Tom Ennis made his way out and got him out of the cauldron, got him at home. He wasn't well. Traynor had gone out to him as he had escaped. Dan Head was lying dead, a young kid, a great, great sportsman, great goalkeeper in both codes, Gaelic and soccer. And they were out there and they were waiting for the nurse to come. And the nurse, Dolores Murphy, I think her name was, she came and did what she could, and then eventually they got him the right treatment, and she said, she actually did a statement, that he survived because of the expert medical work that Oscar Traynor had done on him before I got there. So Traynor was a man of detail, and so he had that. But what's very sad is the 2 of them were like that together, and not long after, Tom Ennis is giving the order to bomb the forecourts where Traynor is extremely young. So the sadness of Irish politics hits you, as well as the glory of the revolution, the sadness of the revolution. But I think, going back, you know, Traynor was loyal to De Valera, and he was to Collins too, but the aftermath of all of the burning of the Custom House, everybody who took part, and I think we should listen to the people who took part, you know, the witness statements of those who took part all say, we should have had better protection around the city to stop the soldiers from getting there so quickly. And Collins didn't want to do that because he felt that was going to be more like an insurrection, and that's not what he wanted. And so the protection of the people who went in to burn the custom house wasn't what it should be. And every one of them, and you know, they were brought to Kilmainham jail. They spent a good bit of time in jail afterwards. Anybody who did statements or who wrote about it, they all said they were glad they did what they did. They were delighted that night that people started carrying out other things just to make sure that morale was high, even though so many of them were in jail. But they all point to the direction, you know, why didn't we have better protection on the outside? And Collins wouldn't have that. And that becomes, to me, a kind of a big wedge then, from what I can see, in terms of the De Valera Collins bit. So De Valera is there with the big media day, and it worked brilliantly. There's no doubt about that. And I one of the things I discovered, you know, in the aftermath of it, before Lloyd George offered the hand of truce, Churchill had made a statement saying, we're sending 100,000 troops over there. We're going to end this. We're going to take every bicycle, every mode of transport. We're going to take every weapon we can, and we're going to end this problem once and for all. So that was the mood after the burning of the custom house. But yet, a few weeks later, you know, Lloyd George is offering out the hand of a truce. So it, to me, there's evidence there to say it worked for what it was set out to do. And I would challenge the easy view that it was a military disaster. Fiasco. Yeah, I disagree with that.
It's good enough for Liz, it's good enough for me.
It was good enough, and you wouldn't tell her otherwise. and the other thing, you know, just count that toll versus 1916.
Oh, yeah.
And you just, you know, which was a military fiasco. Okay. I wouldn't
count the death toll versus, like, a couple of ambushes in Cork, correct, for God's sake. Anyway, yeah. So he then takes the anti-treaty side in the Civil War. Tell me about his involvement in the Civil War.
Well, he was part of a group that refused to go down the route of the treaty, didn't want to, the treaty in play, but he was hanging on, still hoping that something could be done. He went down to Limerick after meeting with Collins in Dublin to go down and avert, as the sort of barracks were being handed back, you know, the two sides were building up, treaty and anti-treaty, and he was right up to, I suppose, the occupancy of the forecourts. He was doing what he could to avoid, you know, an all-out civil war, and even to the point when the anti-treaty side met to work out what their move was, where were they going to go, where their headquarters was going to be, he suggested a headquarters in Parnell Square and had them sort of lined up to do that, where it wouldn't be, I suppose, it would just be known as a headquarters where they could come and go. Instead, the hierarchy decided, no, we're going to make a splash and we're going into the forecourts, and therein lies probably one of the saddest decisions in terms of what was to happen afterwards. Like, not only did Tom Ennis give the order for the forecourts to be taken out and for all of those great rebels that he fought with to go through what they ended up putting themselves through, it must be said, it was done with Churchill's guns and with Lloyd George's guns, which is, how did that happen in that period of time? And Traynor was still trying left and right. You know, there's a famous picture of him in Stony Batter at a meeting of anti-treaty people and supporters, and he's saying, no, I don't think there's going to be civil war. We've got to do everything we can not to. But it wasn't long afterwards that that it descended into that. And I think that's the saddest thing of all. But then the remarkable side of Traynor, having been in and around, he was the most senior member not inside the forecourts. He was outside trying to lay plans for escape, etc. And it wasn't simple, it wasn't easy. He took up you know, in hotel, you know, with the Hammers Hotel. He was in, they were in Barry's Hotel for a while. He was trying everything to give the anti-treaty rebels a chance to get out. And he sent a note that says, you know, set off the mines before you come out. But where the mines went off were where the guys came out. So they wouldn't have set them off where they were getting out. So he's blamed that where the damage was done most, up where all the top records were, which was nowhere near where they survived, that he gets the blame that he was to put it off. But actually, his point was to make an escape and try and get them out, and he also ordered, put in a request to surrender, and that wasn't taken too well by some of the anti-treaty leaders in there. And so here's a man now that's almost at the end of the Civil War. I mean, he escaped up to Blessington. He got caught a couple of months later after the forecourts, but you know, you had doubters now. So it must have been a terrible time, right? The Civil War, but you've people on the pro-treaty side now see him as a complete subversive. You've got people on his own side, anti-treaty, who thinks he didn't do enough. And once again, he wasn't martyred. He wasn't shot. He wasn't killed. He survives again. And I think that doesn't stand up too well when we look back and give people credit. But he did what he could. He went into jail for a third time. Luckily, probably he was in jail because the worst of the fighting might have seen him perish. Jail was actually a good place for him, as it turns out. And I think, I suppose the bit I would say about that time, the Civil War, he never spoke about it much afterwards, and not a lot of people did. But I thought it was remarkable when he came back into the political arena that he was able to embrace pro-treatyites and anti-treatyites. He had made enemies in both, but he was very poignant on, I'm doing what's best for the country. Mm. And that didn't get you brownie points and didn't get you books written about you.
Yeah. Okay, I want to throw it open to the audience, but I want to, before we do that, I want to hear all about when he becomes FAI president in 1948, and along with Joe Wickham, he bests... two things in his favour, by the way. It's in the intervening period. He is, I think we have the Vanguard. We can thank him for the Vanguard.
He brought 12 of them in.
Right. And also, he was he put on a death list by Owen O'Duffy? Because that is a badge of honour.
Yeah, correct, in truth. He was. O'Duffy called him... a subterranean criminal, I think, was
good coming from O'Duffy.
But I think, you know, in terms of that intervening period, he was Minister for Posts and Telegraphs, but he didn't go straight into Fianna Fáil. He wouldn't take the oath. Even when De Valera said it was okay to the oath, he wouldn't do it. But he got thrown out of Sinn Féin for saying they should run in this election. Sinn Féin wouldn't run at all, I think, in the 1927 election. Mm. And he said we should, and sort of sanctioned somebody, say, hey, you should do this, come. And the party reacted by banning him. So he was in a bit of a wilderness for a little while, and then he eventually went to Fianna Fáil, De Valera's oath, which meant so much sort of 8-10 years earlier, it suddenly meant nothing at all. So he found that hard to do, but he got over it and he came into Fianna Fáil. So he got a bit of stick for doing that. But he became minister quite quickly of Posts and Telegraphs. Phones improved in his time. I think it went from 400 to 1,000, you know, it wasn't anything huge. But he would have started the dole, for instance, you know, that people out of work would have some form of compensation. And so he put together the means testing for all that. Post offices, postmasters, salaries, all the different things in creating a new state that were left behind, you know, when the British left. So he kind of was just a practical man at that stage.
But let's get on to...
Football.
Football, yeah. Let's get on to FAI president, 1948. And as I say, along with Joe Wickham, he bests McQuaid, John Charles, in 1955. He defies the omnipotent prelate by inviting Yugoslavia to play in Derrymount Park. Tell me about that massive row.
Okay, so he'd invited Yugoslavia to come in 1951. And it was this is one of the things that we probably don't give soccer enough credit for. At that time, there was no other way of telling the world that we were a republic, that we're a new country. But soccer was being played internationally. And you'll find, before he came in, Wickham, from 36 when he came in, you know, there was games every few months. There was international games, and we're Ireland. You know, we played England, for instance, in 46.
Goodison Park.
Well, we played England at home first.
Yeah.
And the reciprocal was in 49 in Goodison Park. And I think that's my favourite part of his football story. I'll come back to that in a minute. But going on to McQuaid, they made a big announcement that Yugoslavia were coming. And it was a couple of months before it, and they were getting everything in place. And McQuaid went, no, it's not happening. Because Marshal Tito, who was in control of Yugoslavia, had arrested a cardinal and kept a cardinal in prison and a lot of priests for a long period of time after the war. And for that reason alone, Ireland weren't allowed to play against the communists of Yugoslavia. So they learned Traynor was smart, as I said. He was nobody's fool. And he learned that the next time we're going to bring Yugoslavia, we won't give them enough time to ban it. So they only announced it, the opposition, very late on in the day. And things had simmered down a little bit. But anyway, in terms of the Yugoslavia game, the players didn't even know if it was going to happen. There was such a furore in the last 24 hours about it. So McQuaid wanted to come out and publicly, you know, condemn anybody who goes to the church. God will not be happy if you go to this soccer match. And the Legion of Mary lined up outside Derrymount Park. It was a barricade to get through. And Liam Toohey made his debut that day, the great Liam Toohey, who played for Ireland. And he did an amazing interview, which I was lucky enough to get the transcript from years later. Because what had happened, Traynor stood defiant. while others fell around him. You know, De Valera and the presidential officers, everybody was coming
Philip
in.
Philip Green.
Philip Green, the commentator, the famous commentator, pulled at the last
headline.
Minute. The army band. The headline was brilliant. So Philip
brilliant.
Green was frayed at the Catholic Church, and the headline in the evening paper that evening was Reds Make Green Turn Yellow. One of the great tabloid headlines
Absolutely.
Here created in Ireland. And so Traynor was steadfast. He was the only politician. They all dropped like pins. All the ones who said they were going all pulled out. The army band pulled out, so they had to have a stereo, a gramophone, as it were, at the time to do the national anthems. But I think, you know, it was amazing. 28,000 people went into the game and defied Archbishop McQuaid. And that was a huge moment, you know, and it was a real power moment for football as well, you know, what he had done and stood up to this. But I think the last word is with Liam Toohey. Liam made his debut, and when asked about it afterwards, he said, "The only thing I remember these days about my debut was this whole furore about the communists, and when we were lining up before the match, they all blessed themselves on the other team." Right? So much ado about nothing, I think, was the outcome. But there was other matches as well. Douglas Hyde was invited as president of the country. He was invited to attend a match against Poland some years earlier. And you know, nobody had been sort of more of a Gael than him, you know, all the work he had done for the culture, you know, of the new Ireland, as it were. And he decided to attend the Poland game. De Valera attended it, who they didn't like because he was associated with rugby. But the GAA, in their wisdom, having gone on the pitch and shook hands with both teams as president of the state, which was, you know, looking back in any country, that's a great thing to do. With an emerging country like Ireland, within 24 hours, he was banned from the GAA for life. Mm. So that was the president of the country who had done so much for the Gaelic revival, and yet here he was pinned up as a person non de grata. And they allowed him to go to his death without bringing him back into the fold, which was a great shame. Years later, they tried to do stuff about it, and Douglas Hyde Park is named after him. So there's you know, another sort of, I suppose, a spotlight of what it was like at those times. But the one that I prefer and the one that I want to tell you all about the most is Traynor led the touring party that went to play England in the return game in Goodison Park in 1949, 39 years before Ray Houghton scored against England. Oscar Traynor, having been in the trenches, having done what he'd done, finds himself 33 years after 1916, finds himself as president of the FAI, overseeing the Republic of Ireland versus England, the first country in the world to beat England in their home ground.
We may have lost 1916, but we won
40. And you know that there's some great, sorry, you know, and again, football is meant to be the sport of non-Gaels, but yet we're being promoted now, and we've beaten England. It was his proudest moment, I'm sure. Peter Farrell and Con Martin score the goals. There's no songs about them. Christy Moore does songs about Ray Houghton, and I think I get to mention them. But that was an amazing time, because Ireland had just become a republic, and here was the green being worn, and we beat England. Now, England tried ever so hard, and still do, to cancel that result and try and make out that it lasted another 10 years before Hungary beat them. But we were a republic at that time, and I think one of the old codgers in the FAI got FIFA to change it around that we did actually beat England.
If he had been Uachtaráin Cumann Lúchlasc Gael as opposed to president of the FAI, do you think he would be remembered? He wouldn't be a footnote.
Well, yeah, that's a great point. You know, I think he was an outsider. You know, even to his own party, when he joined Fianna Fáil, they weren't sure about him, you know, because he took his time joining. When he became, you know, Minister of Justice at a time in the 50s when the sort of border campaign came on, and his old comrades are attacking and bombing, and he's with a government who are finding them, prosecuting them, and sentencing them to death. Now, he commuted a lot of the debts, but his old team didn't like him because he was sticking to the white line where he felt that he had to be as Minister of Justice. His new team weren't sure about him, and Cumann na Gael certainly didn't like him at all, as you mentioned in Ona Duffy, in terms of what he used to say about him. So he kind of had this loner feel about him. He wasn't entirely Fianna Fáil. You know, it took him a while to get there, but he made the Fianna Fáil seat his own, and him and Harry Colley for many years had two seats on the north side. Charles Haughey ran in 54 against the two of them, but the two of them came out on top. And then again, I think in 59, the next election where Colley lost, he went into the Senate, and Charles Haughey becomes the becomes the TD. And that was the great change, I think, in the shift where he'd been in 1916, saw what the country was heading to, and now sharper, sharper politicians came along, and the new world, the men in the mohair suits, as they were called, were bringing Ireland to a new place. And I think his race was nearly run at that stage. Mm.
Very glad you spotted that photograph in the boardroom of the FAI. And why was this guy fourth? Why is everybody else 2 years? Have you ever heard anybody speak more passionately about anybody in your life before? Okay, I'm going to throw it open to the audience. No, you can you can ask any. I presume they can ask anything they
Absolutely,
want. It doesn't have to be about Oscar.
Congratulations, Niall, on your thesis. It's really a most deserving award to you. It's a fascinating insight on Oscar Traynor.
Thank you.
Miles asked, should he be remembered more? I remember Oscar Traynor. I lived in 10 Dollymount Avenue, Clontarf, in Dublin, and Oscar Traynor and Mrs. Traynor lived in 12 Dollymount Avenue.
Wow.
two doors down. But what's most important to our family, and indeed I think to his as well, when he was, my father was Deputy Director of Intelligence in the Dublin Brigade of the old IRA. And Oscar Traynor was his commanding officer. And years later, my father, after 1932, was accepted into the civil service, and he became private secretary to Dr. James Ryan, great-grandfather of James Ryan, who plays for Ireland in rugby now. And when the Dáil would run late, as it did oftentimes, the buses would have gone, the last buses. And Oscar Traynor would give my dad a lift home in the state car because they lived beside each other.
Fantastic.
But as far as I'm concerned, the best tribute I can pay to Oscar Traynor, and particularly to his wife, Mrs. Traynor, was that I was in the Boy Scouts for several years, as many of us were. And you might remember, or somebody here will remember, Boba Job Week, where you knocked on doors and you did some... cut the grass or cut the hedge and something like that, and you got a shilling. That was the bob. Or some people might give you 2 shillings. But we used to go to Mrs. Traynor's first because we'd cut the front lawn and she'd give us 10 shillings.
Oh, wow. Whoa, wow. Any coin. That's brilliant. I think that all that deserves a round of applause.
Yeah,
that's fantastic.
Yeah.
I think I told you at the start, I did 20 or 30,000 words too much, and it was all scalped by my professor, Professor Will Murphy. But I actually went as far and looked in. So Annie Coyne is not too far from here. She was kind of near, heading more towards Drogheda, but on the Meath side. And as soon as her widow's pension became available, she refused it and said, no, other people deserve it more than me. So I'm not surprised to hear that she was as generous as she was. And remember, they got married in 1918 in the middle of 3 jail terms for him and everything that was going on. And she was hugely supportive. And from you know, just from the grandson, Oscar Traynor, who I know now, who's the most decorated surgeon right now, just coming to retirement, what a lovely man and what a lovely mannerism his family have. And you can see where it came from, that this fellow wasn't a... You know, he probably owes his life to not going to Vaughan's Hotel the night before Bloody Sunday, because they were all going for a drink, and Clancy and McKee were taken out because of it. He went straight home. So we don't have similarities in that respect. I never go home straight, but I'll always stay for the last drink. But I'm delighted. I'd love to learn a little bit more, because he was very proud of Dollymount Avenue. He was very proud of Clontarf, and the family home was only sold, I think, a few years ago. But that's lovely. If anything else, just to meet you today is really worth it. Yeah, well done.
Anybody else? Anything to, any questions? Well, yeah, there's somebody down here, Liam, thanks.
Niall, it's kind of a sports question, if you don't mind.
No problem.
You're a Tipperary man. your father hurled for Tip.
Yeah.
You were Sunderland chairman, manager, and you played for Ireland. What was your biggest sporting achievement?
Well, I played for Dublin, so I was born and bred in Dublin. I was, you know, them blow-ins where your mother and father are from the country, but you end up playing for Dublin. And I was very proud of playing for Dublin. Proud to wear the Irish shirt. I mean, the first time I was picked for the Irish team, I was a sub on our national anthem. It was Jack Charlton's second game. And I stood up immediately and started singing Aran Naveen, and he just turned around and said, is this our one then?
And that is true.
And I'll never forget, I kind of went, he won't last 2 minutes here as well. But it was a great thrill for me to wear the jersey, to But to be honest, I was part of a GAA family. My father hurled for Tipperary, all belonged to them. My mother's people did too. So I was brought to hurling matches all the time. And my dad famously said on Jerry Ryan's breakfast show during the 1990 World Cup, when he hadn't gone to bed, he was still at the bar. Jerry Ryan did the show from the bar near where I lived. He said, "Jerry Ryan, you must be very proud of your son scoring for Ireland in a World Cup." And he went, "I'd much rather it was against Cork in the Munster final." You know? So that kind of sums up our background. I had lots of things. I'm going to tell you the really most stupid one, but it's not stupid because it's one I remember the most. When I was 9 years of age, I won the Dublin Puck Fodder in the community games under 12. And I was picked then to go to the All-Irelands in Mosny. And they said, "You're a bit young." And my mother thought that I'd still be allowed. I've won. They were going to let the second fella, because I'm going. And I won the All-Ireland against all the country lads at 9 years of age. And I won it on 10, and I won it when I was 11. So I kind of got a big head already before I even went into secondary school. That's something that I don't forget. Right the way through then, the more I played my football, London was great, Arsenal. I had the 80s, the Irish crowd came in. And I was part of that. I had two lives. I had my footballer's life, go for a wine bar, drink with Paul Merson, and then I go to see Big Tom with my mates, you know. So I had these two lives going on. Manchester was settled down, time to get married, you know. It was good. There was the Oasis lads got going, but there was other. I wasn't into them. There was more Big Tom stuff to be got. And then Sunderland, to go up to Sunderland and meet the people from the Northeast, hardworking people. The more I went, the more like the Irish I became, and I the best time of all in Sunderland, because I kind of discovered more about myself there. And and I'm going to be really corny now and say, actually getting the thesis done and sort of putting it off till I was 55. If there's anyone here thinking about doing something like that, do it. It gives you energy. It's hard to express that, but you an inner sort of energy that you say it's more than a scratch that you've. Or an itch that you've scratched, I should say. It means more.
And PhD next?
Oh, no, geez, no, not at all. No. My wife is doing that, and it's torture. But anyway, thanks. Thanks for the question. Yeah.
Anybody else?
Niall, I'm just wondering, have you a serious plans to be an historian?
No, not at all. I did this because everyone else in my house was doing something and the pandemic was on. I love it. I read books all the time now. I look on things differently. I wish I knew all this when I was playing. And Sean was around, by the way. Sean was with us on all of the big journeys. He reported for the press initially, is that right? The Irish press, who Oscar Traynor was a director of. Mm-hmm. So there, he was your boss in a funny kind of a way. But I think I suppose the idea, I'm not qualified enough to do that. I'm delighted I got where I got with Oscar Traynor. And the best thing that I heard from the Traynor family was they'd never heard so much or read so much about Oscar. And again, you know, he didn't rush to get a book as some of them did. I'm going to bring up Ernie O'Malley now. I promised myself I wouldn't. But Ernie O'Malley was quite tough on him in his books. I kind of found that difficult to take, because he had actually been part of the group that sprang Ernie O'Malley from prison and got him out, which could have been really dangerous with Frank Teeling had they been there any longer. And because he was a very good writer, O'Malley's wrote some great books on the subject. Lots of books came out. There was books coming out as I was doing the thesis. Two come out.
And they were on the same side in the Civil War.
They were on the same side in the Civil War, but yet O'Malley constantly came at him in his books. Traynor didn't. He stayed on the line in his lane, but Traynor never got to do that. And I do wish. I hope the family would consider reestablishing what he was and the life that he led, the goodness that was in him. Not all good, of course, because he would have been shooting people, and that's the way it was. Life was tough then. But I think it's the Traynors to decide that. And one of the first impressions I get from the Traynor family is he didn't want it there. He didn't want to be shouting about it. He didn't want to be looking for the plaudits. Why should we do that for him now? And I'll respect that, I think. You know, my only other thing to say about all that is the other people who have done the books they've had, they had a retirement dinner for him in Cleary's. in the restaurant in Cleary's in late 1961, just before Christmas. And his colleague, Harry Colley, was leaving the Senate at the same time. So they had Fianna Fáil had a big night for them in Cleary's. And the Traynor family have it on tape, all the speeches on tape, and it's absolutely extraordinary. And Sean Lamass, as Taoiseach, actually speaks and says, Oscar Traynor, of all the books that have been written about 1916, about our revolution, you're the only man who can do a proper one. We await your book. Please give the nation this book. And he walked out from the same place that he'd left to go across to the GPO in 1916. This was 45 years later. And he got off, and him and his wife no longer had a state car. They got the bus home, and that was him done. He never wanted to go and bring it further. So I'm kind of respecting that. But if the Traynor family ever changed their mind, I'd love to get in there and do something about it.
Yeah, my question really was that if you want to be a historian, you have to be a bit ruthless. And when the information comes to you that you can use, you should use it.
Well,
that's the only thing I would say to you, because I think if this man deserves to be recognised, he should be recognised in the round and not just, you know, as some people want him to be seen.
That is an interesting thought, and I'll take it on board. I never feel right about being able to do something. I could collaborate and help maybe, but you know, there's so many things about Oscar Traynor that I'm so glad at least I was able to get out there, just because I was a footballer. But you know, I only know the world of football really, and I almost treated my masters as a pundit, right, for want of a better way of putting it. And I was thinking about today, you know, when you asked me about the background, and I told you why I did this and why Traynor, and I came to, you know, the Ernie O'Malley versus Traynor topic of this great writer of books, you know, The Flame, you know, On Another Man's Wound, all the different things that he's written, They'll Speak to Me, brilliant books and brilliantly written, and look at me, how great I was, and Traynor who hadn't. And I immediately thought, Dennis Irwin is Oscar Traynor, and Roy Keane.
Yeah.
Roy Keane is Ernie O'Malley. And I know Alex Ferguson would have Dennis Irwin on his team first every single time. And that's how I feel about Oscar Traynor. Now, I guess if I was to try and compare, if I was looking at it, I would be the pundit that's saying Oscar Traynor was a brilliant man. If Eamon Dunphy was into the side, he'd say he was average. Good, but not a great player, you know. So I'd feel guilty that I was coming at it from a punditry basis, that I have no idea what I was really talking about, but I loved doing it. I loved the Oscar Traynor that came into my family for the year that he did. And I can actually remember my wife saying to somebody over dinner, we have a third person in our marriage. And I kind of looked at her, but thankfully she said it was Oscar Traynor. So, but nobody had more fun doing a thesis, I think.
That could be a good name for the book when it does come out. No, the third person in my marriage. Okay, I think we're going to have to. Huh? Oh, okay. All right. Well, he's the boss. He said we've time for one more question. So if you've one more question, there you go. All right. This is.
Just can't let you go night without saying it was marvellous talk and all of that, beautiful, lovely to hear it. I just want to know your views on, are the soccer players now getting too much money for every game?
you can most certainly take it from me that the players are paid way too much money. I was around in the old football league, and it turned into the Premier League. I spent half my time in one league, and then this new league came along. And truthfully, for 2 years, there was no difference except the ball and some dancers before the game. Nothing else changed. And then some foreign players started to come in, and they probably did the game a great service in that they weren't going to the pub after matches and celebrating. They would go and have yoga classes. And so the world started to change. And I was caught in the middle of both. To get the most out of my years in the Premier League, I had to start doing things like Pilates. But I was still trying to go to the pub as well. So I was trying to blend my career. But the way it transpired and how it became such a phenomenon, the Premier League, worldwide. It was hard to see. And when I went back to Sunderland, purely on a football motive, knowing that Sunderland could be a better football club, when the Irish guys who backed me, Carl Drummival, bought Sunderland, the idea that we were getting into an industry that was going to become £1 billion industry as opposed to £100 million industry in the top flight, I couldn't have foreseen that. And you know, as hard as we worked, and I was there 6-7 years in that period, I mean, I think the most we got from TV was about 35 million. That sounds crazy money. But now they're getting 135, 235 European ones. And it's going to go on and on and on. And of course, the players are so powerful. But I'm also reminded to tell you, I'll finish with the story that Eamon Dunphy actually told me. Eamon Dunphy went to a meeting of the Players Union in Manchester to try and get the minimum wage, maximum wage.
This is when he was playing for
Millwall. When he was playing for Millwall, abolished. Mm. And so the players came and there was talk of strike because their wage was capped and it was at a very low cap. And two things happened. One, it turned out that Stoke City had broken it and had given Sir Stanley Matthews double. And what they said about that was he was a special circumstance. He was a great player. So a fella stood up and he was the captain of Stoke and he said, I've just been in this morning and I think I've got what I wanted as well. I think we can do this if we all do it together. And when asked what plan did he use, he said, well, he said to me, you know, because Sir Stanley Matthews was paid £2 a week and 18 shillings in the summer, Sir Stanley Matthews got the £2 all year. That was the big win that football had the first time it was broke. And the chairman said to him, I'm not giving you the same as him. You're not as good as Stanley Matthews. To which he replied, I am in the summer. So that was it. And then somebody else stood up from the side, oh, don't strike. We're very lucky. My brothers work in the pit and we play on this lovely grass. And you had, this was the where it all started. And the players voted to go on strike. The league took away the maximum wage. The first bit of TV money came in and the rest is history. I can't defend where it's gone today. Mm. Yeah.
Okay. This is where I normally say that so-and-so will be signing books down the back. Unfortunately, the book has not yet been published. The book is written, but the book has not yet been published. So hopefully the negotiations with the trainer family go well over the next while. And maybe, you know, a year or 2 years from now, I'll be able to say, yeah, Niall will be signing copies of the book, The Third Person in Our Marriage, down at the back of the of the hall. Thank you very
not
much
at all.
Indeed.
Thanks for having me. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You've been listening to a public interview with Niall Quinn about the life of Oscar Traynor, footballer, rebel, politician, and football administrator. Our researcher is Ian Kennelly. The series producer is Lorcan Clancy. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE Radio.